MechCast, Sunday, December 18th, 2011. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Nice to have you with me here on a Sunday evening. Hopefully you're having a great time. Well, it might not be Sunday for you, but, you know, that's when I'm recording this, so that's what I'm going to go with. But I've been having a pretty good week. Lots of things happening in the Apple and Mac news, and I have some great questions from you to get to. You know, this week turned out to be a lot of iTunes stuff. I don't know, some of it was kind of prompted by the episode I did with Ara on the Mac as a home theater system stuff and talking about Apple TV 2s and things like that. So that seems to be what's on your mind, and that's what we're going to go with. Before we get into all of that, though, I want to take a quick moment and thank some of our show sponsors. And the first one I want to tell you about is actually somebody coming back to the MacCast, and that's Audible. I'm very glad to have them back because I'm a big Audible fan. And right now what they're offering is a free 14-day trial of their Audible Listener Gold option. If you go to audiblepodcast.com/MacCast, you can sign up and get the details. But in essence, what it does is it gives you one book credit a month for $14.95. Now, the best part of this offer is you actually get to try out the plan free for the first 2 weeks, and you get a book credit that is yours to keep even if you don't continue on with the program. They have a massive selection that you can choose from, and with your first credit, you can even get the new Steve Jobs biography by Walter Isaacson, which is like 25 hours of audio content. So, you know, if I were picking, that'd probably be the one that I picked up. I have the physical book, but it's a long read at about 600 pages. So why not just listen to it on Audible? Audible also lets you browse and purchase per title, but most titles would normally run you more than the $14.95 that you would pay on the gold plan. So you actually end up saving money by using the subscription. And the best part about Audible is that it syncs with thousands of devices, including your Mac, your iOS devices. If you're on a PC, it also syncs with PC and Android, and they have an ever-growing list of devices that you can actually listen to your Audible content on. So I want you to check it out and get your free audiobook. So head over to audiblepodcast.com/MacCast. Sign up now, and a big thank you to Audible for their support of the MacCast. So let's get into what happened this week in the Apple news. iTunes 10.5.2 came out. Apple claims it includes several improvements for iTunes Match and fixes audio problems when playing certain audio files ripped from CDs. I actually have never personally had any audio issues with my ripped content, and the iTunes Match update feels the same to me. I'm not noticing anything really different, but Apple says it's better, so let's go with that. If you happen to notice an actual change to iTunes Match, something that maybe I've missed, please let me know. Shoot me an email, but I haven't really noticed the changes if they're in there. iTunes Match seems to be exactly the same. They also did release a Thunderbolt display firmware update. This reportedly addresses a fan noise issue affecting a small number of Apple Thunderbolt displays and also improves the stability. If you'd like either of these updates, you can get them through Apple's site for iTunes. Just head over to the iTunes section. You can also, of course, get them through software update on your Macs, or in the case of the Thunderbolt display firmware update, head to Apple's support website at apple.com/support. Looking like this week that iPhones and iPads may get Das Boot in Germany, Mannheim Regional Court in Germany found a validity in an infringement claim filed by Motorola back in April. It's over a patent that covers a method for performing a countdown function during a mobile-originated transfer for a packet radio system. And if you know what that means, please fill me in. But the result is, this is a 3G patent owned by Motorola. They filed suit in Germany, and there has been an injunction made. If upheld, Apple will have to halt sales of all iPad 3G and iPhone devices other than the iPhone 4S in Germany. Apple obviously is appealing the decision, and All Things D points out that the ban only impacts importation of new iOS devices into the country. That means Apple should be able to continue to sell its existing supplies in the region while they work on their appeal. That's going to be good news for Germans who have had hopes of getting a new Apple 3G device under the tree this holiday season, as the supplies should be available, but they will be dwindling as the case drags on. There was some good news later in the week for Apple in the same German court. On Friday, Samsung removed a claim against the iPhone 4S in its 3G lawsuit. They're going after the iPhone models and the 3G iPads, but say that they're pulling back on the iPhone 4S to streamline their case. It's actually more likely that's what's going on, is that a similar case targeting the iPhone 4S in France was denied. The reason is that the 4S uses 3G chips from Qualcomm and not Motorola, and Samsung has a licensing agreement for the 3G patent in question with Qualcomm. Since Apple gets their 3G chips that are used in the iPhone 4S from Qualcomm, they are then, I guess, by proxy covered by the same licensing agreement, so they don't have to relicense with Samsung directly. Here's some good news if you're an Apple fan hoping to eventually maybe get a design job with Apple. Apple has actually hired a iOS mock-up designer who had posted things on YouTube. It looks like Apple has recognized the eye and talent of Jan Michael Kart. You may have run across some of his iOS UI concept video mockups on YouTube or Mac Rumors. I'll have a link to him in the show notes at maccast.com, to his channel over at YouTube if you haven't caught his stuff. Really good. Good things that he's up to. He's done some UI tweaks and concepts for an iOS assistant, essentially Siri before Siri came out, Notification Center, and also the iOS UI that he's played around with. He did also do a concept video for an OS X Lion Messages app, which is something that I'm hoping Apple will integrate it in at some point. They really need to get their messaging in shape on the desktop and, I think, consolidate things. And Jan Michael had some good concepts to that end. And so Ars Technica is reporting that he's been given a 7-month internship in Cupertino, and notes that Apple may be looking to revamp their notification UI. That is coming about because it looks like Apple also rehired former Apple employee and WebOS user interface and user experience designer Rich Dillinger back in June. Dillinger helped design the WebOS notification system, and around the same time, Apple also hired Peter Hajas, and Hajas is a guy who developed the notification tweak, a jailbreak notification tweak, called Mobile Notifier. So definitely Apple is pulling together some of the top notification system designers and could be getting ready to step it up in the notification center in iOS, which I think would be a great thing. They've got a good start, but they kind of picked up, I think, on a lot of the ideas that had been thrown out through some of the other competitors through WebOS and through Android, and it'll be nice to see them kind of working and tweaking and getting some good talent in there to kind of do their own thing or take it to the next level. Guess what? It looks like the iPad 3 is going to have a Retina display. Or did you know that already? This rumor's kind of been all over the place and has been confirmed by multiple sources. This week, CNET cites analyst Richard Shim of Display Research confirming that Apple has suppliers beginning production of a QXGA display, a 2048 by 1536 9.7-inch panel for the iPad 3. He also reconfirmed some of the other rumors that Apple is using three different suppliers for the panels. Samsung, Sharp, and LG Displays are all in on Retina. The panels will still use the in-plane switching IPS technology and not AMOLED, as some rumors have sort of thrown out there. He also claims that Apple hasn't ruled out the option of doing a 7.85-inch iPad Mini. The iPad Mini term is my own term, not his, but doesn't expect it until the second half of 2012, and he claims it won't happen if 7-inch tablets don't have the demand. Now, Amazon said it sold this week 1 million Kindles per week for the past 3 weeks, and that's all Kindles, not just the new 7-inch Fire. I kind of completely disagree with Apple doing a 7-inch tablet. I think Apple isn't even considering the 7-inch form factor at this point. to me, it's a playground for kind of lower-end media tablets and readers, and I think it's one that Apple is happy to concede to Amazon, at least for the short term. For a bit of a perspective on sales, Apple has sold about 11 million iPads in the last quarter. Shim is predicting that the 7-inch Kindle Fire sales will be around 6 million for the same period, so Kindle is definitely coming on strong. And speculation of an Apple 7-inch iPad was followed up later in the week by some stronger rumors. These came from Digitimes, which is always sourcing Asian part suppliers as the impetus for their rumors. Reports claim that the smaller iDevice will have a 7.85-inch display running at a 1024 by 768 resolution and will be made by LG Display and AU Optronics. As Jeff Gamet pointed out over at the Mac Observer, though, these rumors are not new. They've been around for a while and don't necessarily mean that Apple is making a 7-inch tablet. As a matter of fact, Steve Jobs claimed that a 7-inch tablet is considered undesirable by most consumers and requires too many compromises in usability due to the small size. At the same time, though, the Kindle is a force that Apple may or may not decide to contend with at some point, and since Apple never comments on rumor or speculation, there's always the possibility that they may say one thing and do completely the opposite. So it's happened in the past that, you know, they said, we're not doing this, and they turn around and actually do that. And the classic example is the iPod video, where Steve Jobs said, nobody wants an iPod video. And then I think a few weeks later, it came out. So not ruling out the possibility, but I just don't see Apple going after that market, at least not at this point. But should Amazon sales really take off, it might become more attractive to them. iOS 5 Beta 2 also came out recently, was released to developers, and Apple added a bunch of bogus device references in an attempt to obfuscate any pointers to what future products they may be developing. It's often been a source that developers would crack in and look at some of the device references in there to kind of glean and decide what the next generation models of iOS devices that Apple might be working on are. Of course, this latest trick really fooled no one. Developers have already pointed out the references in the current build of the upcoming iPad 3. As far as when we'll see the iPad 3, iPad release dates have jumped around a bit in the rumor mills, from as early as February to as late as April. I would predict that we'll see a late February to early March announcement of the iPad 3 with a late March to early April launch date. Digitimes reports that Apple may also give the 15-inch MacBook Pro a double-res Retina boost. They say Apple will release a 2880 by 1800 pixel screen in the second half of 2012. The assumption is that Intel's new Ivy Bridge technology will help make it possible, because that chipset supports resolutions of displays as high as 4096 by 4096. Back in April, Mac Rumors also noted that Apple was already including some ultra-high-res elements like 3200 by 3200 desktop images and 1024 by 1024 icons in developer preview builds of Lion. So Retina all around on Apple products probably in 2012. It's going to be interesting to see those high resolutions come about, but some of the new chipsets and GPUs and CPUs are really making that possible. iPad and iPhone demand has been better than predicted, or at least maybe, according to a recent AlphaWise survey of U.S. purchase intentions. Based on some recent AT&T statements and the survey, Morgan Stanley analyst Katie Huberty estimated that the fourth quarter iPhone shipments could reach between 31 to 36 million units. That would be far ahead of Wall Street estimates of 28 million and Morgan Stanley's own model estimates of 30 million. That 30 million number was actually echoed by UBS analyst Maynard Oom. Maynard Oom also thinks that Apple may sell between 12 million and 13 million iPads in the quarter. Overall, tablet sales are expected to continue strong growth in 2012, and Apple should benefit. The Morgan Stanley report shows that model predictions with sales of 52 million iPads in 2012, while their AlphaWise survey results actually put the estimates much higher at about 81 million units. The iPad 3 is still predicted in March of 2012, as I mentioned earlier, and it's rumored that Apple may continue selling the iPad 2 at entry-level prices like they do with the iPhones, the iPhone 4 and 3GS being prime examples of that strategy. If there is a lower-cost iPad starting around the $399 range, Morgan Stanley thinks that Apple could sell an additional 22 million iPad units in 2012. The iPad also remains the dominant tablet in Europe. According to data from Context, Apple's iPad accounted for about 74% of European tablet sales in the third quarter. The October numbers show a slight decline to about 72%, but Apple is still far and away the most popular tablet option in the region. The Apple TV has also made a late and surprising impact on the connected TV market this week. Research firm Strategy Analytics predicts that Apple will have sold about 4 million Apple TV units in 2011. They say this would account for about 32% of the set-top box market. An even more significant finding is that 30% of Apple TV owners are buying or renting content with their Apple TVs versus about 20% for other set-top boxes. I think that number is significant because it means that Apple should be able to keep their content deals healthy, which I think in turn could continue to drive Apple TV sales forward. And then, of course, that leads us into all the rumors we've been hearing recently about Apple developing an actual television set. Those are heating up, and we're hearing them from multiple sources that Apple has sort of cracked the TV market, that they're going to bring new devices that are going to offer up new technologies like voice control, and even some rumors are throwing out Microsoft Kinect motion control style controls. I don't know how much I buy that. I don't want to be waving at my TV and having it doing things, but those rumors are out there. Actually, what I still believe is that Apple should license the Apple TV technology and chips to television manufacturers rather than going into the television business themselves. I think if they do that, they can get Apple TV technology in place and then make money from supporting devices like iPhones, iPods, and iPads using their AirPlay technology, and also would benefit from the iTunes integration and that driving more sales of Apple content. I think that's a better way to go, but we'll have to see where that ends up. And not to be left out in the announcements for this week, the Mac is also predicted to have a good end of the year showing. Piper Jaffray analyst Gene Munster has the latest NPD data, and while under what was predicted for Apple, they're still faring pretty well compared to the competition. The first two quarters of the December quarter show a 13% year-over-year growth. Overall, analysts have projected that Apple will sell roughly 5.2 million Macs in the quarter, which should ultimately translate to about a 25% year-over-year growth, so they're a little bit slow into the quarter, but that number could still be viable since the latest data only accounts for U.S. sales, and Apple tends to sell even stronger these days internationally. And if you add to that the fact that December tends to be a hot sales month for Apple, the predictions are still that Apple will end up with a record quarter for Mac sales. According to Munster, Macs should make up about 18% of the company's overall revenue for the December quarter. It's looking like Apple is getting ready to make a significant investment, if not a complete move, into Israel. It was first announced this week that Apple may be in talks to purchase the Israeli flash memory chip design company Anobit. That announcement was shortly followed by rumors that they may actually open an office in Israel, too. That was being reported by an Israeli financial paper, The Globes. They say that Apple will open a development center focusing on semiconductors. As far as Anobit goes, the cost for the purchase is believed to be between $400 million and $500 million. Anobit is much like PA Semi, which was a chip design company Apple acquired back in April of 2008, as they are also a fabless chip design company. Apple is likely interested in Anobit for several reasons. They actually already use the technology in iOS devices and in MacBook Airs. They have a unique flash RAM technology dubbed MSP, or memory signal processing, and they are focused on flash storage, something that Apple has a high interest in when you look at the iPad and the MacBook Air. Anobit has a revolutionary controller chip design and several ideas that are far ahead of some of the things that a lot of the competition has. So by purchasing the company, Apple could essentially lock up that technology and keep the IP in-house for themselves. Supposedly, they would help Apple make flash storage that is faster, more reliable, longer lasting, and that uses less power than the competition. I think it also shows again that Apple is focused on bringing their entire design change from hardware to software all in-house. This would allow Apple to tailor designs and specifications to meet their exact needs. They could then simply bid out the production to various suppliers, allowing them to be flexible on costs and also giving them the ability to ramp up by bringing on new suppliers as needed. This is a strategy that's worked very well with the A5 chips. So they design those in-house and then farm them out to companies like Samsung for the actual production. There's even speculation from Piper Jaffray that eventually Apple may move from not just designing chips, but to actually producing them for products like the MacBook Air. I actually find that a little bit unlikely. I think it's one thing to design the hardware and a whole different game to actually control and do the manufacturing. I just think that's a little bit too far outside Apple's core business. You could argue that they could use their ever-growing war chest to actually buy their way into the manufacturing part, but I think then they would lose some of the flexibility that they have and the advantage that they have with being able to actually source parts out to multiple suppliers and the advantage of bidding those suppliers against each other to kind of get the best pricing. Apple's iTunes Match service this week finally went global, although its start was a little bit rocky. Well, it started smooth earlier in the week with the iTunes Store and iTunes Match actually rolling out officially in Brazil. That happened on Tuesday. Along with music, Brazilians also got access to some movies for purchase or rental. The good news there is that in addition to Brazil, Apple says that the iTunes Store will be coming to 15 other South American countries, including Argentina, Bolivia, Chile, Colombia, Costa Rica, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, and Venezuela. After that rollout on Tuesday, on Wednesday, there was kind of an awkward rollout of iTunes Match to customers in Canada, UK, Australia, and I heard New Zealand. I say awkward because it showed up in the iTunes Store as an option for some people, but after they signed up, they noticed they had either limited functionality or the service didn't work at all. This prompted some to speculate that the early rollout might have been a mistake or just a poor soft launch, and some users who signed up early were even refunded when they complained. By Thursday, it looks like the rollout appeared to be actually official, and now customers in the UK, Canada, Mexico, Ireland, France, Spain, Germany, and Australia are confirmed to have the iTunes Match service access. I noticed that New Zealand wasn't in there and they were referenced earlier. So if you're in New Zealand and you have access to iTunes Music Match, let me know. I think it might be rolled out in New Zealand as well. If you want to know if it's rolled out in your country, you can actually check by looking under your account in the account settings. You'll have to log in to the iTunes Store, go into the account settings area, and there will be an iTunes Match section with a Learn More button. Clicking on that should take you to the page where you can sign up for the service if it's available in your region. Even after it went official, though, the troubles didn't actually stop. While full functionality was there, access to that functionality did turn out to kind of be spotty for some. The issues were likely due to very high demand, a lot of people signing up for the service, and just the system getting overloaded. This was much like the rollout in the US. Apple had problems. You know, they seem to have problems with some of their cloud services from time to time. As a result, Apple did eventually halt new signups in several regions. So there are a number of countries where you can't sign up for iTunes Match. So if you didn't get in early, you might not have access to the service. Apple did this to reduce the load on the server and help improve the experience for those who did sign up. I'm not really sure. I hadn't heard word this weekend on whether or not full sign-up functionality has been restored or not in the affected regions. If you happen to know if it's been turned back on in your area, if you could let us know, that would be great. Just send me an email, maccast@gmail.com. There are a couple of iOS related software updates to tell you about this week. Apple has updated the Apple TV software to version 4.4.4 and released a tweaked iOS 5.0.1 update for the iPhone 4S. Neither of these updates seem to indicate much of what they improve. Despite having the awesome version number of 4.4.4, the Apple TV update simply contains, according to Apple, general performance and stability improvements and a fix for an issue that displayed an error when playing some video content. In the case of the iOS 5.0.1 update, it's simply that the build number has changed for those who re-download or who haven't upgraded to the new version yet. It was revealed by Macworld that the build addresses an iPhone 4S SIM card issue, that in certain situations the iPhone 4S may have difficulty recognizing a micro SIM card, resulting in the following behaviors: either an invalid SIM or no SIM card installed alert appears intermittently, or the status bar changes to show no service or searching in a location where you know you have good 3G coverage. So if you've been noticing either of those things, you might want to do a restore on your iPhone 4S if you're already running 5.0.1, or if you haven't upgraded yet, you might consider upgrading to the latest version. Apple is also still working on a 5.1 update that's in beta and available to developers and is currently in testing, but no word on when we might see an official release of that build. And then finally in the news for this week, something that I think is kind of exciting, it has been reported that Apple's A5 processors may not only be designed in the U.S., but may also be being manufactured in the U.S. as well. Reuters has reported that Samsung is making Apple's A5 processors not in South Korea, China, or Taiwan, but in a recently built factory in Austin, Texas. The non-memory chip production line is said to be about the size of 9 football fields, and according to a source, is producing chips mostly for Apple. The facility reportedly reached full production in early December. Neither Samsung nor Apple are commenting on the piece, but Reuters points out that Samsung has only one other factory that could be making the A5 processors. That's another non-memory logic chip production facility in South Korea, although they believe the Austin location is the one cranking out Apple's A5 processors. Austin is a popular city for chip manufacturing, apparently because the University of Texas has an engineering school that acts as a good pool of new talent. Freescale Semiconductor, ARM, Intel, and AMD, Advanced Micro Devices, all have operations in Texas. Samsung themselves have reportedly invested about $9 billion in the area, according to the Austin Chamber of Commerce, making it the region's largest foreign investor. The new facility reportedly has added about 1,100 new jobs to support the new non-memory chip production line. That's really good news in this economy, which is why I'm kind of excited about this story. They also point out that another 1,300 employees already work at Samsung's NAND flash facility, which is a companion facility near the same location. So great news that the processors are being not only designed, but also made in the USA. And I was happy to hear that story at the end of the week here. So that's going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You know, Notebook is a great application, great way to get organized here at the end of the year, maybe get ready for the new year. What I love about it is you can set up notebooks for all kinds of projects, for research, for travel plans you might be making, and more. You just kind of make one notebook file for each kind of project that you're working on, and then you can take notes, but not only that, you can then set up tabs, set up sections, you can add annotations, throw in sticky notes, and even more to get yourself organized. You can even drop in images, PDF files, and attachments. So you can throw a Word doc in there and link right to it and kind of keep everything together all in one place, all in this single notebook. And then layer on top of that things like audio annotations. You can even throw in video and you can have a whole experience laid out right there in your notebook. So they have free trials available if you want to check it out, if you want to see all the options. They also have great information up on their website to get you started, including some how-to videos that were done by Don McAllister that are really great. So check it all out. Head over to circusponies.com, and a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. One of the new features of iOS 5 that I really like, probably one of my favorite new features, is iMessage as part of the messaging app that allows me to cut back on my SMS charges. But Ars Technica this week had a sort of disturbing piece about iMessages and something that's gone a little bit wrong, I think, on Apple's end. The deal is that iPhone owners who have had their phones stolen, they're doing the right thing. They're going in and then remotely wiping the device, and then they're buying a new phone. But then suddenly they start getting iMessages from the original device that are being sent by the thief or potentially by someone that the thief has sold their phone to. So they went out, they've got a new device. I think in most cases they've kept the same number, and that may be where the problem is. There's also a thread on Mac Rumors with some similar stories and similar stories showing up on Apple's own discussion boards. So I'll have a link to the Mac Rumor thread in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to look into this a little bit further. But the theory is that iMessage is registering the phone number from the SIM card along with the UUID of the device. So even if you swap out the SIM, Apple's servers are using the UUID in their database along with the original phone number of the device to determine how to route and send those messages. So you go to get a new device, but you don't change your number. So you have a new UUID, but you still have the same phone number. Your old device has your old UUID. When the thief sends an iMessage, that information is getting sent up. It's looking in the database, and then it's looking at the phone number, and it's actually sending to multiple locations. So something really strange is going on there. What I'm wondering is, because I haven't run across this personally, I'm wondering if any other MacCast listeners have run across this issue. So I wanted to throw it out to the community. Obviously something that Apple is going to have to address and fix, and would be a little bit creepy if you had your device stolen, you remotely wiped it, and suddenly you're getting these iMessages from the thief or maybe from the person who knowingly or unknowingly purchased your old iPhone. So as I mentioned at the top of the show, my recent episode with Ara Derderian of the HDTV podcast kind of prompted some questions. And I received this one from Josh.
Hello, MacCast. My name is Josh. I'm calling from Denver. I just listened to the latest episode regarding, I think it was Ariane, switching from the Mac Minis to the Apple TV 2s. And I thought it was pretty cool. I myself have an Apple TV 1 that's hooked up to my TV. It's a 160 gig model. And I also have a MacBook Air. I just kind of downgraded and sold my iMac and also my 11-inch MacBook Air to just have one 13-inch MacBook Air. And I'm pretty happy with the setup. However, after listening to your podcast, I was thinking about upgrading to the Apple TV 2. And it sounds to me that if I do that, it almost sounds like I'd have to buy another machine, like a Mac Mini or something. And the reason why I say that is because this is my goal. I would like to put, I've already signed up for iTunes Match. I would like to take all the music off of my MacBook Air and just have it in my network attached storage drive, which I've done. But the problem I run into is when I buy new music. If I buy new music on my iPhone and my MacBook Air is not connected at home, then it wants to create a new library in iTunes on my MacBook Air. And if I just had a Mac Mini at home, headless, kind of like what he was suggesting, then that would act as a movie server for the Apple TV, and also my downloaded content would go right away onto the network attached storage drive. So if you could get back to me about that, because I was really trying to avoid having two Macs and just having an Apple TV and my MacBook Air. My current setup seems to work out fine with the Apple TV 1 and the MacBook Air, because what I do is I buy the content on my Apple TV 2, or my Apple TV 1, sorry, and it's downloaded to that, and then it's also replicated in my iTunes library on my MacBook Air, because for whatever reason, iTunes just decides to download that content in HD and standard definition, so it's already available there for my iPhone or iPad. If you got any more tips on how I could possibly use a MacBook Air with an Apple TV 2 and have it somehow see the network attached drive that's on my time capsule, that would be great. This is Josh from Denver. I hope that all made sense. Love the show. Thanks.
Hey, Josh, I'm going to try and get this right. I think that all made sense to me. Here's what I'm assuming. I'm assuming that you've moved your iTunes folder to an external volume, your NAS drive that's hooked up to that time capsule. But what happens when you do that is when your MacBook Air isn't at home and that volume isn't mounted and you launch iTunes, it will create a local default music folder, which is your iTunes media folder inside your iTunes, inside your music folder in your home folder. And that's its default behavior. And then what happens is when you get back and you connect back to your network and you launch iTunes, it'll see, oh, there's the NAS volume. I'm going to connect to that. So when you're away, any local music will get put into that home music iTunes media folder. Now, this should actually work for you because all you need to do is when you get home with your MacBook Air and you're connected back to your network and the NAS is mounted on your MacBook Air, you just go under the file menu in iTunes under Library and choose Organize Library. And then you'll see a little checkbox that says Consolidate Files. Check that and click OK. What that's going to do is it's going to copy anything that you downloaded or purchased when you were away from your NAS music folder. It will copy all of that over from the local folder over to the remote volume. And then it will update all the pointers in your iTunes library file. At that point, you could actually go into the local iTunes media folder and on the MacBook Air and delete any of those copies because they will have copied over to that NAS drive. Now, this assumes that you have the options set correctly in the iTunes preferences. So before you do any of this, go into iTunes, go into preferences, go under the advanced setting and make sure that you have the Keep iTunes Media Folder Organized and Copy Files to iTunes Media Folder options checked. If those are checked, this will all work. If you don't have your setup done that way, then it's going to be a little bit trickier for you to kind of figure this stuff out because you're going to have to move files around. So I'm not really sure what you're doing, but assuming you're doing it that way, this should all work. Another way to handle this, since you are using iTunes Match, would be to simply delete the copies of the stuff that you purchased while you were away from your NAS drive and then re-download them via iCloud when you're hooked back up and connected locally. Again, that might be a little bit more manual and a little bit more cumbersome, but it should work because, once again, the way iTunes works when you've set up your media folder to be on an external volume or on a network volume and then you're disconnected from that, it kind of rolls back. It does this default thing where it defaults back to the default location, but the minute that you're hooked back up to an external drive or that remote location, it should refine that and repoint itself back at that area. So anything that you've downloaded or re-download from iCloud, in this case through iTunes Match, at this point should go to that NAS drive. So I hope that all made sense. If anybody else has another recommendation or tip for Josh, please send that along and I will try and share that on a future episode. Now, I guess there's just iTunes Match and network attached storage drives are just generating a lot of questions. And I think a lot of this goes back to my complaints that Apple doesn't really have a good centralized home music sharing solution. And I think a lot of us really want this. And I think Brad is in this exact same situation. Brad is a relatively new Mac user. He has a house with Windows PCs with iTunes on them and even has a Linux box, he told me in his email. His music is actually managed on a network-attached storage device on a NAS drive, and then he has several devices that he wants to play back on. He has a Blu-ray player that supports the Digital Living Network Alliance technology, DLNA, which is pretty common these days, and he wants to keep all his music on the network-attached storage device and also wants to be able to enable iTunes Match. And so he had a few questions related to that. Using iTunes, he doesn't use the allow iTunes to manage music and copy the music to an iTunes media folder option. Both of those are off. And so the question is, if you enable match and you have those, if you enable match, are those required to be turned on? And the short answer to that is no. You don't have to have those items turned on to use the iTunes Match service. But he then also was wondering, well, if I go ahead and want to download the 256-bit versions, the AAC versions, to replace some of my lower quality MP3 files through iTunes Match, are they going to automatically substitute the versions that I have on my network attached storage drive, on my NAS drive, that I've brought music in from iTunes? So I should maybe back up for those of you who don't know, when you don't allow iTunes to manage your music and copy it to the iTunes media folder, you can actually drag and add music from, say, like a network attached storage drive or an external volume or wherever you want on your Mac. You can throw those into your iTunes library, and then it's just going to set up pointers to those, to that media. It's not actually going to copy it anywhere. So when you're set up in that situation, it'll go ahead and play in iTunes. But in the case of enabling iTunes Match, again, when you turn that on, it's just using the metadata. It's using the iTunes Genius stuff and the metadata to make those matches. So you don't need to have those features turned on. But also with iTunes, the key to anything that gets downloaded from the iTunes store is going to be where you have your iTunes media folder pointed, because it's still going to use that to determine the location where it actually saves files. So, Brad, in your case, if you're asking, you know, is it going to replace the lower quality MP3s that I have on my NAS drive? Well, you just have pointers to those files on the NAS drives. Anything downloaded from iTunes through iTunes Match, through iCloud, is actually going to end up in your media folder. So the short answer to your question would be no, but it is going to depend on how you have your system set up, and I'm not entirely sure. If you have actually pointed iTunes, the actual media folder location, in the system preferences in the advanced section at the same volume where all of your music files are stored on your NAS, then they could potentially delete them. But if the media folder location is set to the default, say your home folder, your music iTunes folder, your music folder, iTunes media folder, if I can remember that path correctly, if it's set to that, when you re-download or download those 256 kilobit versions, those upgraded versions, it's going to go to that location by default. And so I played around with this a little bit, and this is, I'm making some assumptions here, so I'm going to kind of try and lay these out as much as possible. I'm assuming that because of your background with Windows and Linux, you just had your network attached storage drive and you had all your MP3s stored on there. When you set up iTunes, I'm going to assume you just had iTunes set to its default, so it's added, pointed at the default media storage location. And then because you didn't have the copy music files over set, that you just took the folder from your network attached storage drive, dropped that into iTunes, iTunes scanned it and created all the pointers to that external location. So now your iTunes library file, the metadata, is kind of pointing at those locations. And when you want to upgrade to iTunes Match, the first thing that you're going to do is quote unquote delete the local copy, which in your case is really not going to delete the audio file. It might even ask you if you want to actually remove the media file, but probably not in your case, since you're not actually you don't actually have those media files managed by iTunes. It's probably going to ignore it because it's going to say, oh, it's off on the NAS drive. I'm just going to, you know, remove the pointer to it. So now iTunes doesn't think that you have that piece of music stored in the library, and it's going to give you that little iCloud icon so that you can re-download it. So it's going to remove that reference. Now when you re-download it, you click the button to re-download the 256 kilobit version, it's going to download it and store it in your local library. Okay, so now you're going to have that copy, and you're going to have also the 128 kilobit per second MP3 that's sitting off on your NAS drive. At that point, your option would be to manually drag the 256 kilobit version back over to your network attached storage and then either replace it or put that back into iTunes. It's going to get a little bit tricky. The other option you could do is you could point the media folder at the NAS drive, but leave the organize and manage options off. That way, when you delete the lower quality track, what it's actually going to do is going to ask you if you want to remove the original or leave it in place. So you'll have the option at that point to delete it. And when you re-download from iCloud, it's actually going to go over to the NAS drive, but we'll use the iTunes managed folder structure. Even if that option's turned off, you're going to leave that turned off in the system preferences, but iTunes by default, when it's re-downloading stuff from the cloud, uses that folder structure where it's going to create a folder with the, I believe it is the artist name, and then inside that a folder with the album name, and then inside that the actual tracks themselves. So if that's not the folder structure you prefer to have on your network attached storage device with all of your music that you're playing through other devices through DLNA or maybe on your Linux box, something like that, that's just something to think about. The other thing to keep in mind too is that if you set this up to work with iTunes Match and the iTunes versions, and you're going to replace them, your MP3s with AACs, you're going to need to make sure that everything that you play your tracks on support AAC playback. I know not all devices and not all systems support AAC. So the stuff coming from iTunes through the Match service is AAC, so just be aware of that. So I hope I explained all that correctly. Might have been a little bit confusing, but I think you get the idea, and that should give you enough to go off of. Again, if anybody has additional suggestions or recommendations for sort of managing iTunes music on network-attached storage and doing that to multiple devices, not just Apple devices, but also third-party devices, specifically ones that are in the DLNA, the Digital Living Room Alliance, Network Alliance thing, I'd be curious to know a little bit more about that. So send your comments along, and we'll try again to share those on future episodes of the MacCast. Something I believe I mentioned from time to time on the MacCast is that for my internet connectivity, I do not use the domain name service or servers from my internet service provider. I actually prefer to use the OpenDNS domain names. And I got an email from Joe this week, and Joe wanted to know about how I went about setting that up specifically on my airport. How do you change the default DNS settings from the ones provided by your ISP, typically through your DHCP connection, and change those to use the OpenDNS ones? And I thought maybe I should back up a little bit and talk a little bit about why you might want to use an alternate domain name service provider outside of just using your ISP. And the reasons you might want to do that is I've found sometimes your ISP might be down or unreliable, depending upon you who they are. In my case, it's Cox. And, I've just had some outages. And, you know, another thing that can happen is they might be blocking some specific sites, depending upon the place you live or where you're at. Maybe you don't like them doing that. And another reason you might want to use an alternative DNS provider is there's additional features. OpenDNS, one of the things I like about it is it maintains a malware and a spyware list. So sort of known nefarious websites where you probably don't want to be going there. Or if you accidentally click a link, something in an email, which happens, you know, we talk about safe browsing habits on the MacCast, and I always tell you don't click unknown links, but you know, maybe you're see something from a friend in Twitter or on Facebook or through an email, and it's got one of these shortened links, and you don't really realize it. And before you go, oh, that was really dumb. I shouldn't have clicked on that. And suddenly you're someplace you don't want to be. Well, if that's in OpenDNS's malware spyware list, they actually throw up an interrupt page and say, look, we found this site to contain, you know, stuff that you probably don't want to access. And they'll throw up a warning message. So you can do that. They can also allow you to log and block specific sites. They have some parental filters. You can do whitelisting and blacklisting. So if you want to keep your kids out of certain areas of the internet, you can do that, and you can kind of control those sorts of things. So there's a lot of different advantages. And so if you want to change to using these domain name servers versus your ISPs, the first thing that you need to get is you need to get the IP addresses for whatever service you want to use. And there's a few out there. OpenDNS isn't the only one. Another good one to check out is Google's. I'll have links to both of them in the show notes at maccast.com. But you go to their sites and they'll give you the IP addresses. In the case of OpenDNS, the two servers are 208.67.222.222 and 208.67.220.220. If you want to use Google's, Google's servers are 8.8.8.8 and 8 .8.4.4. So those are the primary and secondary domain name servers for each one of those services. And those are going to be the numbers that you're going to have to plug into Airport, or if you use some other third-party router, it's going to be a similar process through their web interface. Now, setting it up with an Airport is relatively easy. The first thing you're going to want to do is launch Airport Utility. You'll find that in your Applications folder under Utilities. The application is called Airport Utility. Launch that. Something I found interesting as I was working on the research for this story, I thought, I'll cover how to do this on the Mac from Airport Utility and how to do it on the new iOS app, which is awesome. If you haven't seen the iOS app, Airport Utility app, and you have an iPad, an iPhone, or an iPod Touch, you should really check it out. You can do a lot of configuration on it. I could not figure out a way to change the DNS settings on an Airport base station from the iOS app. So if I've totally missed something and you know how to do it, let me know. You can actually, when you're running the app, click on the internet icon, which is like the top node, and you can see the configuration. You can see what DNS server it's using, but I could not find a way to edit it. So if you happen to know that, please share that with me. I'm going to do a little bit more research into it, but right now it doesn't appear that you can actually do that. But if you have Airport Utility running on your Mac, launch that. And then you're going to want to select the base station from the list on the left and then click the manual setup button. Once you're in that screen, go ahead and click on the internet tab and then go to the configuration section. And then in there, click the setting on the settings panel, click the TCP/IP tab. And then you're going to want to change the DNS server values to the IP addresses that I mentioned earlier. So if you want to use the OpenDNS ones, plug those in or plug the Google ones in. And then once you have those in place, go ahead and click update. And then at that point, the Airport is going to reset. It's going to reboot. And when it comes back up, now any clients that you have that connect to that Airport base station should get those DNS settings as their settings for connecting to the internet and resolving IP addresses. So that's how you do it there. Another option that you have, if you don't want to do it at the router level, if you just want to do it on a client-by-client basis, on a machine-by-machine basis, you can actually do that as well. So you can just override the DNS settings. And this is particularly useful if you're going to take your machine out on the road and you want to make sure that you always use OpenDNS or Google, you can actually plug these in manually into your network settings on your Mac or on your device. And so how to do it on the Mac in OS X, you go into System Preferences, and then you go into the Network System Preferences. You're going to select the interface that you want to configure, typically your built-in Airport card, but it might be your Ethernet card, you know, whatever you want to configure. And then in the main panel, click the Advanced button. And then you're going to click on the DNS tab in the Advanced Settings pane. And then under the DNS settings, you're probably going to see the IP address of the router that you're connected to. So it's probably going to be a local IP address. And so what you want to do is at the bottom of the DNS servers column, you're going to see a little plus icon. Go ahead and click that, and then you can enter the OpenDNS IP addresses or the Google IP addresses into that area. And you need to do it twice. You need to do it for the primary IP address and then again for the secondary IP address. You can actually ignore the search domain columns, the search domains column that probably has a value in there too, a default value that's grayed out. You don't need to really worry about that. It's just the DNS settings that we're going to adjust. And then go ahead and click the OK button and exit the system preferences. And then that client should be using whatever DNS servers that you've plugged into that configuration. On iOS, it's a somewhat similar process. You're going to go into the settings under general and go into Wi-Fi, and then you need to find the Wi-Fi setting that you wish to configure. It's going to be the one that is checked, or the one that is checked is going to be the one that you're currently connected to. You could configure one that you're not currently connected to, but not going to do you much good. So you're going to want to find the one that you're currently connected to. Go ahead and click the little blue arrow icon to the right of that to go into its settings. And then look for the DNS listing and tap that to actually edit its settings. And then you're going to enter the IP addresses, the DNS IP addresses that you want to use, either OpenDNS or Google or some other service. And you're going to do it, in this case, since you have two of them, you're going to separate the two IP addresses by a comma. because there's only one line to enter the IP addresses into. And then go ahead and back out of your settings, and you should be finished. And now that iOS device should be using those servers as their DNS servers for doing IP lookups and domain name resolution. And that's it. That's how you do it either at the router level or at the client level. And Joe, I hope that answers your question. Now, moving back to iTunes, I mentioned, right, that this is going to be kind of an iTunes heavy episode. I got two final iTunes tips to give you, and this one is somewhat an unknown feature in iTunes, but I found it can be extremely helpful, especially when adjusting your metadata related to sorting tracks in iTunes, specifically albums. Gary pointed out after my iTunes Match comments that Apple, in their purchased music metadata, lists the artist with the first name first and last name last, which you think would be great, but then also sorts them the same way. And as Gary pointed out, if you're a traditionalist, if you ever worked in a music store or just in life in general, in most places, when you're sorting music by artist, you typically use the artist's last name to do the sort, not the first name. And iTunes kind of has this wrong in a lot of ways, if that's the way you think about it. And I certainly do, and I think Gary does also. And so the way that you can correct this sorting problem is by actually setting the sort metadata. And a lot of people, I think, don't realize that there's actually a separate sort of field in the metadata where you can set up sorting. And so the way you get to this is you select the track in iTunes or the group of track in iTunes, and then you choose File, Get Info. Just hit Command I to bring up the little info panel where you manage the metadata. And then you'll notice there that there is a sorting tab. So you go into the sorting tab, and then you'll see two columns, kind of left column with the data that is the standard data that would normally be viewed in the columns in the main list in iTunes. And then there's also on the right-hand side a whole set of sort columns. And in this case, we're going to look at the sort artist field. And then in that field, what you can do is you can enter the name as you would want to have it when you're doing sorting. So in this case, we'd put the last name, comma, first name. So an example I could give is if you were using Bob Dylan, the default sort, if you bought some Bob Dylan tracks through iTunes, is that Bob Dylan's going to show up in the B's. Well, you probably want him actually in sorting to show up in the D's for Dylan. So go into the sort field, go under sort artist, and you type Dylan, comma, Bob, and then hit OK. And you're done, your metadata will be updated. And now when you sort the artist column, it's going to show it in the proper order, even though the actual column itself will say Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan tracks will actually show up down in the D's where they should be. And if you actually want to see both representations, you can go up and, you know, right-click on the columns and then turn on the sort artist column so that you can see Dylan, comma, Bob, and then Bob Dylan in the artist column. You'll also notice while you're in that sort entries metadata pane that there are entries for name. That only appears when you're editing a single track, so you can sort of adjust any track titles that you want to have different sorting on. You'll notice album artist. This is particularly helpful if you have a compilation where there's a bunch of artists maybe on the album, but just one primary artist that you want to have that sorted by. Also a sort album and sort composer column, as well as a sort show column for podcasts and TV shows and things like that. So I actually use the sort column to eliminate what I call the issue. By default in iTunes, if you have, a show title for a TV show that starts with the, or in the case of the MacCast, you really want MacCast to show up in the M's, not the T's. And so you can go into the sort column and put the proper name or value that you want to have the sorting work on, and that can be separate from the actual metadata that's displayed in iTunes. So cool little trick. A lot of people maybe do or don't know about that, but I wanted to share that one. And Gary, I think that would help you get your sorting back the way that you'd like to have it. And then this final iTunes tip is actually more of a tip coupled with a plea. I guess it's a solution that I figured out based on a listener question, but I'm not entirely convinced that I came up with the best solution. So I got an email from Shannon, and he wanted to know if there was a way to switch between the different libraries in iTunes using the keyboard. So in other words, to be able to switch between the music, movies, TV show, podcast, iTunes U libraries, whatever libraries you have up there in the left-hand column under libraries. And I guess this will go for switching to the store and your different playlists and things like that. But say you're listening to a track there in iTunes, how can you navigate completely with a keyboard into those different sections? And the best thing that I could come up with was this. One, you have to make sure that the Genius sidebar is turned off. So this kind of, in order for this trick to work, that has to be turned off. Otherwise, it gets all screwy. So the first thing to do is turn that off. Command-Shift-G is the keyboard shortcut for turning that off. So you hit Command-Shift-G, and then make sure that the currently playing track is selected in the main library. To do that, hit Command-L. That'll select the currently playing track. And then you can now press Shift plus the tab key to tab over, get your selection over to the library sidebar. At that point, now you can use the arrow keys to move up and down to the desired library. And then when you get to the library that you want to access, you hit the tab key. That's going to move the selection back to the main library list. And now you can use the arrow keys to navigate down to the specific track that you want to start playing, and then hit the enter or return key to start playing the desired track, TV show, whatever it may be. So that was one way I could figure out to completely control this from the keyboard. It's not perfect, but it works. If you have a better way, please share it with us. Send me an auto comment. Tell me I'm an idiot and that's really complicated, or maybe tell me I got it right. I don't know. Maybe that's the only way to do it. But if you could share that with us, that would be greatly appreciated. And I'll try and cover that again on a future episode of the MacCast. So that's going to do it for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and recognize all of our show sponsors. Phoronix, makers of Deep Freeze. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at phoronix.com. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. Get free trials as well as more information and details at circusponies.com. Smile, check out Text Expander PDF Pen Disc Label. They have free trials and more information available over at smilesoftware.com. Audible, get your free audiobook and a 14-day trial of Audible Listener Gold over at audiblepodcast.com/maccast. And Gazelle, you know, you can get cash for that old those old electronics and do it quickly and easily using Gazelle's service. Check it out. Do a quick search over at gazelle.com. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Big thank you to you for your support. Please keep your emails, your audio comments coming. You can send those to maccast@gmail.com. Or you can call in on the listener hotline, leave voicemail there. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you call in on voicemail, if you could leave your email address and spell it out for me, that's greatly appreciated. If you prefer to use Skype, maybe save some long-distance charges, you can leave voicemail there also. My Skype name is The MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those at the MacCast website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum. That's at forum.maccast.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. That's going to do it for this week. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.